Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Great podcasts deserve a great platform. That's why Pocket Cast delivers a beautifully designed, simple but powerful experience that offers more control. It's the premium app for podcast listening, search, and discovery. And it's now free. Download Pocket Cast today at pocketcast.com or find us in the Apple app or Google Play stores.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 29th of February, these are our main stories. The latest on the coronavirus, as the World Health Organization labels the global risk of the outbreak very high. The UN describes the rising conflict in Idlib as one of the most alarming moments of the Syrian war. And the United States and the Taliban are set to sign a peace agreement. Also in this podcast, how did our ancestors exchange ideas before the internet, books and writing? And
sometimes it's so painful. At the moment, I'm doing athletic, and this athletic, I have hope that it will change everything, no matter the pain that I have gone through.
One woman's journey from South Sudan to a Kenyan refugee camp to the Olympics. The coronavirus continues to spread across the world. BBC Persian has learned that at least 210 people have died in Iran, far higher than the official figure of 34. An Iranian health ministry spokesman rejected the BBC report in a tweet. Elsewhere, Nigeria, Mexico, New Zealand, Belarus, Iceland and Lithuania have all announced their first cases of the virus. In its latest update, the World Health Organization has upgraded the global risk of the outbreak to very high, the highest possible level of alert. Our Geneva correspondent Imogen Folkes has been following the story.
The head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros, said that he and his colleagues now assessed the global risk of the coronavirus outbreak as very high. But as soon as he said that, he sought to kind of allay big fears by pointing out that although it is in over 50 countries now, 22 of them have had only one case so far. So what he stressed over and over and over and over again was containment is what needs to be done. Countries can still interrupt transmission, contain this virus, as long as they take what he called robust and aggressive measures. Are countries ready to do that? We heard a bit of a more somber warning from the head of the WHO's Emergency Health Programme. That's Dr. Mike Ryan.
Health systems around the world, and I mean North and South, are just not ready. So containment isn't just a concept of interrupting transmission and hoping to put the virus back in nature. Containment is a way of slowing down this virus so health systems can cope around the world if they receive this virus. And our determination right now is that health systems around the world are not ready.
So imagine we get these daily updates from the World Health Organization, but they are, to coin a phrase, a bit samey every day. We just hear the same rather vague messages that it's getting worse. It's not quite a pandemic yet, but it might be soon.
The strongest and repeated message that has come from the WHO is this is not a virus quite like flu. It doesn't seem to be spreading that fast in community transmission. That's what health experts worry about. And that's where they say you can actually do something about it. They have been holding up China, some may disagree with this, but holding up China as a prime example. Strict measures seem to have interrupted transmission in China. And so some countries, and here in Switzerland, the Swiss government is one of them, are taking this example. We've seen quite a shock announcement this morning, public gatherings of over 1,000 people banned. All sorts of things that people here were looking forward to are just not happening. The Zurich Opera is closed, rock concerts cancelled, football matches being played behind closed doors. But that's the kind of action I sense the WHO wants to see.
Imogen Folkes with me from Geneva. Tensions are rising in Syria, where Turkey and Russian-backed government troops are fighting for control of the northwestern province of Idlib. The UN is calling it one of the most alarming moments of the Syrian war. The conflict has escalated in recent days after 33 Turkish troops were killed in a Syrian airstrike on Thursday. Since then, Turkish forces have killed 31 Syrian soldiers in retaliation, and the Turkish president has spoken to both the Russian and US leaders to ask for help in averting a humanitarian catastrophe. İlnur Çevik is chief advisor to President Erdogan. He told my colleague James Menendez that Turkey was furious about the airstrikes, which he believes were deliberate.
I don't think it was any mistake. It was a deliberate attack. It's an aerial attack. They're saying the regime attacked us because they do have jet fighters. And we feel it was the Bashar Assad regime.
The Russians, as I understand it, control the airspace, though, over Idlib.
Yes.
Are they complicit in this attack, then?
Well, I mean, some way or another, of course they should be. Because, as you said, they are controlling the airspace. They know what the Syrians are doing. So would the Syrians do something that the Russians would not like? I don't know.
How has Turkey responded?
Well, Turkey is furious because as we talk to the Russians, we see that suddenly somebody attacks our soldiers. You know, there's a process of talks, diplomatic initiatives, and suddenly in the midst of all that, as if we're not talking to each other, the killing of Turkish soldiers so brutally and so unexpectedly has angered all Turks.
Our Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, told me more about the situation.
I think it's a consequence not just of the last 24 hours, but of the way that the war's been going now for a period of years. Ever since foreign countries started intervening, the whole nightmare scenario has been that two of them, two big military powers, would come into direct conflict. And that is what appears to have happened. And the challenge now is to try to stop the whole thing getting worse. But what makes it hard to do that is that they support different sides in the war. Assad and the Russians are committed to Assad's final victory, taking back the province of Idlib. The Turks have put a great deal of treasure and now blood into making sure that doesn't happen. So unless they manage to reimpose some kind of a ceasefire or either side steps back, then confrontation seems to me to be built into the mix.
And Turkey presumably is looking for a way to climb down from conflict without looking like its honour, its national honour has been undermined.
Well, I think maybe the Russians are as well. Neither side want this because don't forget, behind Turkey is the NATO alliance. There are many steps between what I'm about to say and where things are at the moment. But under the terms of the North Atlantic Treaty, Turkey can appeal for help from all of its allies. No one's suggesting that's going to happen at this particular time, but that's always in the background. That's the whole point of the NATO alliance. So the Russians are going to be a bit cautious as well. Putin, by intervening in Syria, has, he would say, made Russia once again into an international power. And Turkey as well is a country with a lot of national pride, and they will not want to see 33 of their men killed in an airstrike and for it to go unanswered. So it's a really difficult and dangerous moment, one of the most dangerous moments of the war.
Our Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen. On Saturday, the United States and the Taliban look set to sign a historic agreement which could pave the way for an eventual end to the fighting in Afghanistan. This follows a week-long reduction in violence in the country with the Taliban, Afghan army and US-led forces promising not to carry out major attacks against each other. Our South Asia correspondent Sukunda Kamani reports now from the northern city of Kunduz on the hopes and fears of some of those worst affected by the violence.
I'm standing at a busy roundabout that marks the centre of Kunduz city. Around 100 young men have gathered here to celebrate the reduction in violence and call for a longer-lasting ceasefire. One's carrying a large bunch of white and blue balloons with "I love you" written on them. This is a city that's been overrun by the Taliban twice in the past 5 years. Behind me is a poster with the faces of policemen killed in a suicide bombing at this roundabout last year when the Taliban tried to take it again.
For now, though, there's an atmosphere of hope.
We are very happy. We have come out in support of peace. In the last few days, it's been calm in Kunduz and across the country. We want a ceasefire to last forever.
Attacks in cities might get more media coverage, but much of Afghanistan's war is fought in rural areas. We travel to a village just outside Kunduz, held by the Taliban for around 3 years, before the government retook it a few weeks ago. By a canal, local farmers are washing carrots they're planning to sell at the market. But many of their homes have been left badly damaged. One elderly man sifts through the wreckage of his shop, destroyed in an airstrike targeting the Taliban.
There were 4 Taliban fighters. They climbed over the wall into my house to hide. I told them, go away, or an airstrike will destroy the house. But they said no.
Another is in a wheelchair. He lost both his legs when he stepped on a landmine planted by the Taliban.
Do you think you can live together with the Taliban? Can you forgive them for what happened to you?
What can we do? We don't have any other place to live. Everything I have is in this village. There is no choice but to learn to live with them.
Almost everyone we've spoken to here in the village wants to show us the destruction caused to their homes by the war. There is a sense of hope now that the violence could eventually come to an end. But the US Taliban agreement alone won't do that. A lasting peace will have to be thrashed out in separate discussions between the Taliban and other Afghan political leaders. Discussions which are yet to begin.
Those talks are likely to be made more complicated by a messy and potentially dangerous political dispute over the results of Afghanistan's presidential election. Ashraf Ghani was narrowly declared the winner, but his main rival, Abdullah Abdullah, has threatened to form a parallel government, alleging fraud. Other major questions remain. Can the Taliban accept democracy? Will they respect women's rights? Jamila Karimi is a former local politician.
When the Taliban reach a peace deal, they will have to accept the Afghan constitution, which gives women the right to work. But the most important thing is no one will be killed.
Other women and men are understandably nervous about the prospect of the Taliban ending up with a role in government. They wonder what the price of peace could be. But this week has given Afghans a glimpse of what life free from war looks like.
Our correspondent Sukuna Kamani in Afghanistan. A study has found that ancient hunter-gatherers formed small social networks to exchange ideas and knowledge. According to anthropologists in Britain and Switzerland, frequent interactions between different camps would have helped speed up our ancestors' cultural evolution. Oliver Conway has more.
Before the internet, books and even writing, how were ideas spread? Anthropologists believe that hunter-gatherers living 300,000 years ago would have had their own social networks, dropping into different camps to exchange information. Professor Andrea Miliano says our ancestors displayed the kind of fluid social structures not seen in apes and used it to gain knowledge vital for survival.
This interaction could be just going and leaving the same camp or just going and visiting someone. It's not a pre-booked visit. They don't have cell phones. They just go. But you get the opportunity to observe people doing things in a different way than people do in your own camp. So this could be observing how you produce a specific tool for fishing, for hunting, or it could be they exchange a lot of information on medicinal plants that are important for treating a specific disease.
The scientists monitored the behavior of modern hunter-gatherers living in isolated areas in the Philippines and found they had many more interactions than previously thought, moving on average every 15 days and traveling to distant camps. Archaeological and genetic evidence suggests that these types of fluid structures date back hundreds of thousands of years, and they explain the cultural and technological revolutions that have characterized human development.
Oliver Conway reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
We originally just thought we should write a book about, you know, a little girl that's plus size that is just living her best life.
The new book for little kids that's tackling a big social issue. Next to Serbia. Protesters in the capital Belgrade have gathered outside the city assembly to demand clean air. It's part of a coordinated demonstration in five Balkan cities. Serbia is the most polluted country in Europe, with other countries in the Western Balkans close behind. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay told me about the pollution in Belgrade.
If you go to the bridges across the river in Belgrade, across the Sava River, you can quite clearly see in the morning and often throughout the day how polluted it is. You can sometimes find it hard to make out the shapes of the tower blocks of New Belgrade. And some people do indeed say they can feel it when they're walking around, running, cycling, whatever it is they're doing on a daily basis. People that I know have said, I never thought I had asthma, but this winter I've been suffering from it. And the statistics actually do bear out these facts. So we're talking about many thousands of deaths and illnesses every year because of air pollution.
What's causing it?
There's a few different things, and these are common to most of these countries that we're talking about. One of them is old cars. So, for example, Serbia's got a particular problem. They still import cars which have been built to what's known as the Euro 3 standard. So these were the standards for pollution which applied up until 2005. Serbia is the only country in the region which still allows imports of those cars. And of course, as you can imagine, as a result, it's become a bit of a magnet for old cars that nobody wants to run. But there's also solid fuel heating. People still heat their homes with solid fuels. They can, in some cases, heat their businesses as well. And it's not necessarily the cleanest kinds of solid fuel. And in fact, we've heard over the years in cities like Skopje, the capital of North Macedonia, people will more or less throw anything into a stove, whether it's wood, coal, or indeed plastic. If it can burn, it goes in. And finally, there's quite a bit of legacy industry from the days of the former Yugoslavia. And the standards of the industrial filters to control the emissions levels of these industries and the power stations as well are perhaps not the best. All of that's contributing to producing this smog that we see and that people's health is suffering because of.
And have the protesters who are out this evening got any chance of getting the cleaner air that they want?
They're talking about planting a lot more trees, banning these older, more polluting cars, trying to encourage electric vehicles. North Macedonia is looking towards a zero-carbon future. They've announced plans anyway to convert coal power stations to becoming solar power stations. So I think the countries are realising that they've got a problem which is affecting the health of their citizens, and they do need to do something.
Our correspondent Guy Delaunay. 4 years ago, the first ever refugee Olympic team competed at the 2016 Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro. One of the 10 athletes that made up the team was the 1500-metre runner Angelina Lahalith. Originally from South Sudan, Ms. Lahalith was forced to flee to a refugee camp in Kenya, where she started running competitively. She told my colleague Alan Kasuja about her journey.
I came alone. In fact, I was helped by one of my relatives. I left all my siblings and my parents behind. We escaped during the night when the war broke out, and we managed to shift to another area whereby there was a lot of protection. We could, during the day, we could stay, but during the night, we could sleep inside the forest. Then during the day, we come back until it continued that time. Then there was a UN bus, and that was the bus that we used to manage to Kakuma refugee camp.
So you come here as an 8-year-old or 7-year-old child. You don't know how old you are. You come with relatives. You leave your siblings and most of your family in South Sudan. Your parents are still in South Sudan?
Yeah, they are still in South Sudan.
When was the last time you saw them?
2002, December.
That was the last time you saw your parents?
Yeah.
You haven't seen them since then?
No.
How does that make you feel?
Sometimes it is so painful, but I keep on having hope that very soon I will be able to see them. That is why I continue working hard and continue going to school, because I know education will change me. And at the moment, I'm doing athletic. And this athletic, I have hope that it will change everything. No matter the pain that I have gone through, I'm sure it will end, and I will be able to meet with them.
Are you in touch with them?
No. They live in a remote area, but sometimes I used to find people who come from South Sudan who meet with them, and then sometimes they give me the information.
So, because I was going to ask you, with all that, you know, seeing as you haven't been in touch with them all this time, it might be that, you know, they might not be there anymore. Is that something that you've thought about?
No, I always pray that God should protect them until the day I will be able to meet them.
Is that one of your great ambitions, to see them again?
Yeah, I always pray. Before I go to bed, I always pray that they should be alive until I meet.
And I know this is difficult for you to talk about. Do you need to take a break? Okay, she needs to take a break. I'm sorry. She needs to take a break. It's a difficult thing for her to talk about. Tell me a bit about your daughter. Son or daughter?
Son.
2 years old almost. Has he started running yet?
Yeah, he do usually. Yeah.
He runs with you?
Active, yeah.
When you think about your son, what are your dreams and aspirations for him?
For me, I wish to work hard to support him in a full way.
Angelina Lahalith with Alan Kasuja. The ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has failed in his latest attempt to prevent the publication of 2 court judgments in a custody battle with his ex-wife, Princess Haya of Jordan. But details of the judgments can't yet be made public until the Sheikh decides whether to take the case any further. Princess Haya fled to Britain last year with her children, reportedly in fear of her life. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
Today's decision by the Court of Appeal was unanimous. The 3 judges dismissed the appeal made on behalf of Sheikh Mohammed not to publish the fact-finding and other judgments in his ongoing legal battle with his former wife. Princess Haya and the media all want those judgments to be made public, and the appeal court agrees. But Sheikh Mohammed has one more avenue open to him. He and his team have until Tuesday afternoon to lodge an appeal with the Supreme Court to keep the judgments out of the public domain. The case follows the alleged abduction by Sheikh Mohammed of 2 of his daughters and the subsequent alleged intimidation by him of Princess Haya.
Now, if you have children, here's something for their reading list. Her Body Can. It's a new children's book just published in the United States. It's about an 8-year-old girl who is plus-sized, but her weight doesn't bother her. It's the first book written by the bloggers Aidy Meshka and Katie Crenshaw, who are both mothers themselves. Ms. Crenshaw told my colleague Nuala McGovern where the idea came from.
My friend Addie and I were having a conversation about how plus-size characters in children's books are not common, if they exist at all. And if they do, it is bullying-centric, or they're having to overcome something that's negative. And so we originally just thought we should write a book about, you know, a little girl that's plus-size that is just living her best life.
What does she do?
It's kind of a rhyming affirmation book. So every spread is her tackling something that she enjoys doing, and her size isn't stopping her. So she goes shopping, she goes to the pool, she runs a race. Just subtle things that some people might think that people with bigger bodies can't do or wouldn't do.
Does it talk about food at all in it?
It does. We have a spread where she talks about how she enjoys cake and kale because they're both delicious, and that food is fuel, and it's also for fun.
Because people feel that there is a real problem in the United States with childhood obesity, and sure, that normalizing a plus size kid may not help tackle that issue.
Yes, I think that the root of any negative issue comes from a place of disconnect from self and a place from not loving ourselves. So I actually think if we changed the conversation to be more appreciative of who we are on the inside, a lot of the other things would start to kind of correct themselves.
So talk me through that a little bit further. You think if there's more self-esteem, there would be less childhood obesity?
I do, in a grander metaphoric way. Mm-hmm. I think that so far what's not working is a fatphobic society where we treat people who look differently like they're less than or they can't do as much. And that doesn't even go into all the children who may be in bigger bodies because of illnesses or medications. I've already received one message from a mom who said this book is life-changing for them because her daughter has leukemia and her cancer treatments have caused her to gain a lot of weight. I think that loving ourselves and understanding what our bodies can do will empower us to be the healthiest people we can.
The blogger Katie Crenshaw with Nuala McGovern. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of the Global News podcast to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
If you're paying attention to the headlines, you've heard about ransomware, a computer virus that locks your files until you pay a ransom. But did you know that more and more businesses are under attack? The key to stopping ransomware is protecting yourself before you're attacked. With Carbonite, if your business becomes infected, you can recover clean files from their super secure servers. Best of all, you don't have to remember to upload files. Carbonite does it automatically. Try it free at carbonite.com/podcasts and receive 2 free months if you buy.